Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In the front lines of that war at the moment, very clearly, is the state of Israel. Its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is to be addressing the joint session of Congress, convened apparently without the blessing of the Obama administration and despite its very strong objections. There will be much talk, I'm sure, on Capitol Hill and elsewhere about the contents of his remarks. Before that is delivered, though, we want to get the insights of Professor Alan Dershowitz, who has been giving a lot of thought to this speech, to the necessity of it, and to the conduct of those in Congress and in the executive branch at the moment who take strong exception to it being made at this time. Professor Dershowitz, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us, sir.
Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
You have been writing, I think, rather forcefully and in a lot of different places about the fact that the peevishness is kind of the way I think of it, of the administration over Benjamin Netanyahu not having secured some sort of blessing from the administration before giving this address to Congress, seems misplaced, to say the least, given the importance of his speech. Talk a little bit about that speech and why you think it is misplaced.
Well, first of all, the president doesn't have to seek the approval of Congress when the president invites somebody to the White House. There's no reason why Congress, which is a co-equal branch of our government, has to seek the approval of the president. The president isn't angry that he wasn't notified. What he's angry at is what Netanyahu was planning to say. He's planning to oppose the current negotiations and the current deal. If Netanyahu were coming to praise the deal, the president would be thrilled, just as he was thrilled when he sent David Cameron, the Prime Minister of England, to lobby the Senate in favor of the administration's opposition to sanctions. So this is all about content, and it's all about the separation of powers and the importance that Congress has, the role it has to play in checking and balancing when the president is making a mistake. And this deal with Iran is a serious mistake because it has a sunset provision. It basically says that in 10 years, which means 6 or 7 realistically, the Iranians will be encouraged to develop nuclear weapons. They'll be allowed to develop. They'll have a green light to developing nuclear weapons. And that's a terrible, terrible mistake.
Yeah, and guess it goes without saying, but let me just say it, that there are an awful lot of other provisions of this deal that put them in a position to do that in rather short order should they decide to opt for a nuclear weapon, if they haven't really already done so.
Well, they've opted for a nuclear weapon. I have no doubt about that. And they've also opted for cheating. And they know how to cheat. They build facilities that are secret. We discover them. And then they say, whoops, and they go on and build the next one. That's been the pattern for over 10 years.
Yeah. And to compound it, they've also been defying, even in this negotiating period, no less, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is supposedly going to be keeping them honest. I mean, this really strikes me as a fool's errand at best. And to have Bibi Netanyahu say that to the Congress seems to me, as it does obviously to you, to be of supreme importance at the moment, especially, Alan Dershowitz, as it seems as though the president is determined not to submit this deal, assuming he gets it, to the Congress for its advice and consent or other approval.
He's already said that, and that's wrong. This is very treaty-like in its implications. It's the most important foreign policy agreement of the 21st century. And the idea of the president having the power alone to bind the United States is in violation of everything our Constitution was intended to prevent. And I think Congress has to take a role. The Constitution says all money bills have to originate in the House of Representatives, and the sanctions are a money bill. All treaties have to be affirmed by the Senate. This is treaty-like in its effect, and I think that the role of Congress is critically important, and we have a constitutional crisis in the works if the president thinks that he can bring about a deal like this without any input from Congress at all. He's making a very serious constitutional mistake.
Boy, I fully concur. Talk a little, if you would, Professor Alan Dershowitz, as you see it, of the stakes here in terms of a bad deal, both for Israel, and you, of course, have written, among other things, in your 30 nonfiction works, the case for Israel, but what about the case for America in terms of the threat that this Iranian nuclear state could pose to us as well?
Remember that the deal does not prevent Iran from continuing to develop its intercontinental ballistic missiles. They're designed to reach the United States, to reach Europe, to reach American troops around the world, not to reach Israel. They don't need intercontinental ballistic missiles to reach Israel. So this is crucial for American security, and it's also crucial for America keeping its promises, because the President of the United States has promised, most recently, 15 minutes ago, through the speech being done by Samantha Power, that Iran will never be allowed to develop nuclear weapons. But this says something different. This says, yes, you will be able to develop them within a decade, which is really within 6 or 7 years, realistically.
Yeah, and there is indeed the certainty that you will find others responding to this prospect.
Oh, no question.
Right away.
Saudi Arabia will want its bomb. The Emirates will want their bomb. The Egyptians will want their bomb. This is going to be the end of nuclear nonproliferation, which is, again, another promise that the administration made. I mean, I voted for the President of the United States based on his promises, including nuclear nonproliferation, including that Iran would never be allowed to develop nuclear weapons, and now we're seeing those promises at the very least compromised. So I think Congress has an absolute responsibility to serve as a check and balance. Congress, after all, was elected more recently than the president, and president does not have a mandate to act alone. The two most recent elections of the president and of a Republican majority in the Senate and the House send a mandate to our government to act in coordination and to serve as checks and balances the way our framers intended.
You have, of course, as you've mentioned, Alan Dershowitz, been prominent in your support for this president and for the Democratic Party more generally. And yet you've leveled a very, very tough criticism of him in a comparison to Neville Chamberlain in this regard. Develop that theory, if you would, please.
Well, Neville Chamberlain was a great prime minister of England domestically, and he went down in history as a terrible leader because he failed to recognize the greatest danger of the 20th century, namely an armed Adolf Hitler. And I'm fearful that President Obama, who's done, in my view, very good work domestically, people can agree or disagree with that, will go down in history as the 21st century Neville Chamberlain if he ultimately allows Iran to develop nuclear weapons, which this deal looks like it is leading toward.
Yeah, I guess the question really is, as much as anything, is it actually encouraging the further pursuit of nuclear weapons by, as you've indicated, legitimating it and in clearing the way, essentially, for it to happen? Alan Dershowitz, let me ask you about one other topic that you've been also turning your considerable talents to, and that is anti-Semitism on the rise in Europe. You've recently been traveling there. What did you see, and is what you've seen, in your estimation, symptomatic of a far larger problem, both in Europe and perhaps beyond?
I think so. What we're seeing is various kinds of anti-Semitism. They're very different. One is the traditional old-fashioned fascist anti-Semitism, which is arising in Greece and Hungary, but nowhere else in Europe, really. Second, we're seeing Islamic extremist anti-Semitism, high levels of anti-Semitism among Muslim communities all over Europe, and then violence among small numbers of Muslim extremists, such as we've seen in Toulouse, France, and in Paris and other places. And then we're seeing hard left-wing academic anti-Semitism, which pretends to be anti-Israel, but really is Holocaust denial. People who compare what Israel's doing to the Palestinians to what the Nazis did to the Jews are Holocaust deniers, because if the worst that happened to the Jews at the hands of the Nazis is what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, then there were no gas chambers, there were no mobile killing squads, there was no genocide, and there was no Holocaust. So we're seeing hard-left academic anti-Semitism now pretending to be anti-Zionism, but really being a new form and the most dangerous form of anti-Semitism.
You mentioned a moment ago the speech that Susan Rice gave to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Outside of those convention halls, as I understand it, Code Pink has been equating the Jewish state with the Islamic State.
Right.
Might that fit this pattern?
Is a virulently anti-Semitic organization. Code Pink is anti-American, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, and tragically, There are some people on the left who support Code Pink because, you know, they like the fact that it's run by women, all of that. But it is a horribly bigoted organization that does not belong as part of the American dialogue.
With that, we have to let you go. Professor Alan Dershowitz, as always, your candor as well as the clarity of your thoughts are very much appreciated here. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, Dr. Daniel Garay joins us. We'll talk about a new index of U.S. military strength and the warnings contained in its findings. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm pleased to say we're joined by a friend and colleague of many years and someone I greatly admire, Dr. Daniel Garay. Today he is a vice president at the highly regarded Lexington Institute. But he has many accomplishments in his past, including time in the senior ranks of the United States government, notably as the director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He has been a professor, a member of the Department of Homeland Security's Advisory Board, and in numerous other capacities, he has been contributing mightily to the national debate about our national security. Dan, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
One of your most recent contributions actually was in connection with an important new project of the Heritage Foundation, Dan. They call it a military index, and I'm very keen to know what you and your colleagues there made of the current state of U.S. military strength.
Well, thanks. A very good first time out of the blocks for the Heritage Foundation. This will be an annual event and a real resource for all of us. What did was look at the requirement to provide the capabilities to fight two near simultaneous wars. That's the standard we've had since the end of the Cold War regimes, Democrat and Republican. And what they concluded was that we were barely able to fight one war. That's a conventional war. Nothing said about the nuclear forces. They did mention that, which are also declining, which means the conventional and the strategic deterrent are both in a very weak state.
Yeah, I want to come back to that in a moment, Dan, but just for the sort of broader purpose here, you're saying that this is a kind of baseline against which to evaluate how we're doing in terms of the military capabilities that, well, most immediately the Obama administration is providing for, and it's well short of what's required to meet that historic standard of two nearly simultaneous conventional conflicts. And this augurs ill at a time when the prospects for such conflicts are growing by the day. We're visiting with Dan Gray of the Lexington Institute. He is their vice president and a contributor, most recently, to an important new project with the Heritage Foundation, an index of U.S. military strength. And Dan, you were just saying that the effects of having shortfalls, set aside the nuclear for a moment, but shortfalls in our conventional forces is dramatic. What does it suggest in terms of the possibility that we may be actually emboldening enemies to think that they can be aggressive against us and our interests?
Well, increasingly, the problem is that if we get tied down in one region, could be the Middle East, could even now be Europe, we're back in Europe, an aggressor in another region, Iran in this case, or perhaps North Korea, could see the opportunity to act aggressively, not necessarily start a war, but at least push the envelope with the idea that the United States won't respond nuclear unless they do and cannot respond with conventional forces. And since we have interests in at least three, if not four, major regions of the world where conflict is now ongoing or dictators are now building their militaries, that's a very bad situation.
It is indeed. And we can talk about each of those in turn. I guess you're talking about Ukraine in Europe. Obviously, the Middle East is awash with conflict at the moment and the likelihood for more growing by the day. The Far East, North Korea is one possibility. China may be another. Are you talking about the Latin American context or Africa is another possible area for military operations?
We are beginning to see with the expansion of Boko Haram, the Islamist groups in Mali and even parts of Algeria, the Sudan, you could see much of at least the northern part of that continent also inflamed, much more of it even. So now you're talking about potentially four regions. That doesn't include anything that happens in the homeland. If there's a natural disaster, that doesn't include the things we do for anti-piracy, for drug interdiction. So in a sense, this is a 5-pound military being asked to carry a 10-pound weight. It just won't work.
And worse, again, it creates conditions that may be beyond our control, that when we look at adversaries who are not engaging in a similar kind of reduction in their military capabilities, far from it, are building up, it seems to add by the day to our peril. Dan, let me ask you about the nuclear piece of this, because you've mentioned that the index sort of did not address that. What, in your estimation, as a serious student of these matters, is the current balance between the United States nuclear deterrent forces on the one hand and those of, say, Russia, China, even those that are now being amassed by North Korea and, it appears, Iran?
Look, we're on the knife's edge of losing our strategic deterrent. All of the countries you've mentioned, Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, are all modernizing their nuclear forces, acquiring more weapons, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and the like. China is also working in anti-space systems. We're the only one of the nuclear powers that is not modernizing our forces to any significant degree. We are upgrading real old weapons, in the case of the B-61 bomb, and just beginning to start a replacement for the Ohio-class submarine. No plans and no money to modernize the land-based element of the force. So we're 20 years behind where we should be. And if money situation gets worse, another recession, this becomes a real question, not of just guns versus butter, but of domestic stability versus our international security.
In addition to modernizing forces, Dan, I've been struck by one other feature of what seems to be afoot now with those various countries you're talking about. Each of them has, in the space of the past year, indicated a willingness to use nuclear weapons against the United States, or at least is very clearly contemplating such use against us, the Chinese notably talking about attacking 10 of our cities with submarine-launched ballistic missiles and causing millions of casualties with, you know, downwind effects of radiation. Is this a symptom, in your estimation, of their seriously discounting our deterrent?
It clearly is. I mean, you would think that the idea of a small country or one with a limited arsenal threatening such an attack, not thinking that we would retaliate not just in kind, but massively, is really crazy. But yet that's the situation we're facing. These countries think, perhaps it's because of the nature of dictatorship, that they may be actually able to get away with it, or will use that threat in order to protect themselves from retaliation when they conduct conventional aggression against their neighbors.
Yeah, and as we'll be talking about throughout the program, this prospect is particularly alarming with respect to one nation that is on the cusp of obtaining these nuclear weapons and seems to be getting a green light from the Obama administration to do so, namely Iran. Dan, I wanted to ask you about one other issue that I know is very much on your mind, and you all do terrific work on this at the Lexington Institute. I didn't see it in this new index by the Heritage Foundation, but it seems to me it bears very directly on the adequacy of our military readiness, namely the condition of our defense industrial base. How would you characterize it, and should it be part of an index that tries to assess a real baseline for where we go from here?
It certainly should, and I think they're going to add it in. If you don't have a strong industrial base, you can't respond to a threat, you cannot provide the means for sustaining forces overseas in the event of a war, and we're at the edge. We have declined to having just a handful of major defense companies that can make submarines, ships, bombers, fighters, and the like. The second and third tier companies are being challenged by the decline in the defense budget. And once you lose some key suppliers that make very sophisticated electronics or sensors or other hardware, it may take you months, possibly years, to recover. And it's a very hard thing to protect if you are not providing these companies with at least some ongoing production so that they can generate revenues and keep the doors open.
This obviously puts us in considerable jeopardy if those American suppliers are not available at times when we need them. Dan Garay, for this, among many other things, we very much value your advice and your insights. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, Seth Cropsey joins us. We'll talk a bit more about the naval component of the challenges we're facing and what we better be doing about that. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The assassination outside the Kremlin last week of Vladimir Putin's most prominent and effective critic was, as the communist used to say, no accident, comrade. Boris Nemtsov was reportedly about to disclose proof that the Putin regime was engineering the violence in Ukraine. To be sure, this is not exactly news. The Ukrainians in the West have contended that Putin was responsible ever since so-called separatists engineered Crimea's takeover and annexation by Russia. Still, the prospect of Nemtsov courageously marshaling the evidence of Kremlin complicity, given his stature as a former Russian deputy prime minister, evidently was seen as intolerable by Putin's friends. Such a conclusion seems inescapable, since Vladimir Putin has announced that he will personally oversee the investigation into the Nemtsov assassination. That should ensure the perpetrators are never found. This is Frank Gaffney with a Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by a colleague of many years, a man who has served in senior Defense Department positions, as well as in his present incarnation as a senior fellow and director of the Center for American Sea Power at the Hudson Institute. He is Seth Cropsey. He was at various points in the past a deputy undersecretary of the Navy and acted as an assistant secretary in the portfolio of special operations and low intensity conflict. He's the author of a superb book on the state of American naval power. It is entitled Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. Seth Cropsey, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Delighted to be here, Frank.
You wrote recently a very thoughtful piece and I think timely in terms of its warning to us about what is developing now, not only with the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, but also on the periphery of the Mediterranean in Libya, and what that might portend for commercial shipping and other vessels transiting that very important body of water. Talk a little bit about the threat that an ISIS on the littorals of the Mediterranean might mean for our interests and those of the free world more generally, Seth.
Well, I think your audience remembers the Achille Lauro incident from 1986, it was, and the terrorist hijacking of the ship and the sad events that followed. That's probably the least likely scenario, least likely possibility, which is that ISIS would simply use a port to equip a small boat and then go rake a cruise ship with fire. It would be devastating, and it would certainly get a lot of attention and kill a lot of people. But I think more likely than that is that there are lots of Libyans who are trying to escape the civil conflict there, and they cross over to islands en route Italy. And if ISIS could control parts of the Libyan coast, they could put their own people, include their own people in those boats, and some very dangerous folks in Italy. And I think that's a real problem.
Well, and I wouldn't discount the possibility that shipping might be threatened in various ways either. There's also, as you know so well, a desire on the part of these guys to engage in sort of spectacular atrocities and thereby build their reputation, I guess, as a force to be reckoned with. And Seth, I guess what this calls sharply to mind is the inadequacy of our naval presence in these waters at the moment. Talk a bit about the past history of deploying forces into this Mediterranean and where we are today.
Well, up until the Cold War, we had a couple of aircraft carriers and an amphibious ready group in the Mediterranean along with their escort ships. So, for example, when incidents like the Benghazi one, where our ambassador was killed, would take place or could take place, there would be forces there that could respond very quickly. Today, the Sixth Fleet, the Mediterranean, U.S. Mediterranean fleet, consists of a single command ship based in Italy and a handful of guided missile destroyers based in the western end of the Mediterranean. Unfortunately, all the action is taking place in the eastern and the central Mediterranean, so we're not really deployed in the right places. We could be. We have basing agreements. We have naval facilities in the eastern Mediterranean not being used as they could be. But more important than that, or at least no less important, we don't have the ships and personnel there that are needed as this region becomes more dangerous and more volatile.
That speaks to the larger question, which we were talking about earlier in the program with Dan Gray, Seth Cropsey, and that is the force structure today is simply inadequate to meet the needs of our nation and our alliances. He was talking about a recent project of the Heritage Foundation in which Dan participated, as you may know, the kind of set a baseline for an index for U.S. military strength, as they call it. In the day when we had two aircraft carrier battle groups in the Mediterranean, we obviously had considerably larger numbers of those assets than we do today. Could we put even one carrier battle group on permanent station in the Mediterranean should the need arise, let alone one plus an amphibious battle group or two carriers?
We couldn't put two. At the time that we had two carriers in the Mediterranean, we had 15 carriers. Today we have 11. So it would be a stretch. The Mediterranean is one of the three central places for naval power, for American naval interests in the world today. The other two are the Persian Gulf and the West Pacific. And we have a very, very small presence in the Mediterranean, and the Mediterranean is becoming more and more prominent, the pivot notwithstanding.
And this really speaks to the point that we've been talking about throughout the program, which is the provocativeness of American absence or perceived weakness. Seth Cropsey, again, is our guest, former senior Pentagon official under both the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, currently the director of the Center for American Sea Power at the highly regarded Hudson Institute and author of Mayday, The Decline of American Naval Supremacy. Seth, before we turn to the Pacific pivot, if you will, I wanted just to ask you one other question that was evident in your piece in the Wall Street Journal, namely the behavior of Turkey at the moment, a putative ally, and yet at a time when there is so much ferment in the Eastern Mediterranean, it seems to be behaving rather badly. What's up there?
Well, Turkey has changed its direction from being pro-Western to being anti-Western under the now President Erdogan. And so they try to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza, a blockade that was established in order to prevent weapons from reaching Hamas. They're actively helping Hamas. They're quite ambivalent about what's going on in Syria, seeing it as an opportunity to go after the Kurds. As you know, they did not allow American forces transit during the Iraq war. So Turkey is actively abetting terrorist organizations, to say nothing of its dismal human rights record and the stated ambitions of the current Turkish president to lead the caliphate. And I think you said it much more briefly and succinctly when you called it a putative ally.
Yeah, well, that you've added texture to the point that it isn't and shouldn't be considered as such any longer, it seems to me. Seth, let me turn quickly because we're almost out of time. You've spent a lot of time focusing on Asia, notably directing the Heritage Foundation's project in that part of the world for a time, as well as, of course, in your official capacities. What do you make at the moment of our relative strength vis-a-vis the Chinese Navy, as it seems to be expanding by leaps and bounds?
Well, our relative strength today is good. If you look 20 years ahead, which in naval terms is a very short time because it takes 10 years from when the money is appropriated to when the ship is in the water. If you look 20 years ahead, things start to get bad. And the pivot is a pivot in name only. In military force, as you know, this administration is raiding the Defense Department for over $1 trillion. So things don't look good. And when I think of the pivot these days, I think of that line from the Three Stooges where one of them says, you know, slowly I turn, step by step, inch by inch. I mean, it's a joke.
It is a joke. And unfortunately, it's no laughing matter. Seth, I hope you're right that things are relatively good at the moment. But boy, it sure looks to me as though the trend lines have already begun to cross.
I'm speaking in terms of capabilities. In terms of what we actually do, I agree with you. Things don't look so good.
We are unfortunately out of time to discuss that point further at the moment, but I hope we'll be able to do so again in the near future. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll get his take on what's happening on that front and others in Asia at the moment. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We will never fully understand what we've asked of our military service members, of their families, or their children, asking them to deploy, patrol, stay on watch, on point, asking them to put themselves in harm's way, to endure it all. But we do understand that it's our turn, our duty, to bring them all the way home, to keep them secure, to have their backs for the rest of their lives. Wounded Warrior Project long-term support programs do whatever it takes to help our most severely ill or injured veterans live independently at no cost for life so that they might stand at ease. Find out how you can help at findwwp.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm a firefighter.
A teacher.
I'm a farmer.
I'm a barber.
A waitress. A mom.
We're all part of your community. Every day we move in and out of each other's busy lives.
It's easy to take for granted all the little moments that make up our everyday.
Some are good,
others not so much.
But that's life. It's when you experience a moment of uncertainty, something or someone's behavior that doesn't seem quite right.
These are the moments to take a pause.
Because if something doesn't feel right, it's probably not.
It's not about paranoia
or being afraid.
It's about standing up and protecting our communities.
One detail at a time.
Because a lot of little details can become a pattern.
We
trust our instincts.
Just like you should.
Because only you know what's not supposed to be in your everyday.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's time for our weekly visit with Gordon Chang, the duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio and at Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com, Fox News, and so many other places on matters involving Asia. Gordon is, of course, the author of two very important books, as well as his various columns in those outlets. They are The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, where to begin? Maybe in Russia. We've had the assassination of a leading critic of Vladimir Putin, Boris Nemtsov. What do you make of what happened in that instance, Gordon, to the extent we know the details as of now?
At this moment, we don't know who is responsible for the assassination of Nemtsov. Some people suggest that fellow dissidents did this. But I think it's much more likely that Putin himself is responsible. And the reason is that there is a long line of assassinations of Putin opponents, clearly with an intent to intimidate Putin's adversaries. So this probably falls into that line. Clearly, though, we know that someone is trying to destabilize the regime. And I think that it's important that we look at Russia as an unstable state, one with nuclear weapons, and therefore extremely dangerous, especially with someone like Putin at the helm.
At this moment, we're seeing the Chinese expressing rather strong support for the Russians. You had their ambassador to Belgium make a representation last week that the West really is responsible for the present crisis between it and Russia, rather than what Vladimir Putin has been doing in Ukraine or elsewhere. What do you make of this alignment, Gordon? I know it's not a surprise exactly to you, but this seemed to be a rather public effort by the Chinese to show themselves in solidarity with a man who is in various ways, including the one you've just mentioned, behaving rather badly.
This is a signal of real partnership between Beijing and Moscow. The Chinese, especially over the last half of 2014, took a number of steps to support Putin, including undermining sanctions with a number of economic measures. So this is going to be the big story, I think, of 2015. And this indeed is the worst trend in the world today, the growing partnership of Moscow and Beijing in alignment with North Korea and Iran and in opposition to the United States and the rest of the world.
Speaking of the rest of the world, we were just talking with Seth Cropsey a bit about what's happening in the Western Pacific at the moment as American naval presence and power projection capabilities seem to be on the wane, and those of China seem to be on the rise. What is happening in that regard, Gordon, and what kinds of responses do you anticipate the Japanese, for one, and perhaps the Indians, for another, might make as this trend continues?
Yeah, there was very interesting testimony before the House Armed Services Committee about a week ago in which an admiral said that China now has more commissioned submarines than the United States has. We have 71. And so the Chinese have a large fleet. Now, of course, many Chinese submarines are not that capable. They're very noisy. But at some point, quantity is quality. The fortunate aspect here are two things. First of all, as you point out, the Japanese and the Indians are building up their fleet very quickly. So are other countries in the region. So China as a whole probably is not making that much progress. Also, I think that there will be a change in American defense posture, largely because we're going to be forced to by the Chinese and by the Russians as they get together. And I think that there's going to be a new appreciation for the need for defense, something that you've been talking about for a very long time.
Yeah, the things that I guess are concerned me in that regard are, one, the Chinese seem to have put the building blocks, at least, in place for a vast ramp up of their production, construction of ships of various kinds. Gordon, at the very moment, as we talked about with Dan Garay in an earlier segment, the U.S. defense industrial base is very much on the wane. And this combination gives rise to a trend that Seth Cropsey indicated could prove to be quite problematic down the road. Let me ask you about one other facet of what China's up to at the moment and what you make of it. In your Forbes column, you talk about the remonopolizing of China's industry. On the eve of a major National People's Congress this week, Gordon, what is going on in that regard, and what does it say about the status of the Chinese economy and government?
Well, in December and in February, the Chinese central government made announcements of essentially putting together state enterprises into big monopolies. In the 1990s, we saw the breakup of state enterprises, the breakup of the monopolies to allow competition. This was considered to be reform. Now China is regressing, going in the opposite direction. This has occurred in the train-making industry, in the nuclear reactor industry, and probably it will occur in the state energy sector as well. This shows, I think, that essentially China is not reforming. And without reform, I don't think the Chinese economy can continue to grow. But in the meantime, this week we have the National People's Congress meeting in Beijing. There's going to be an announcement on China's defense spending, increases in the budget. Everyone's going to be looking at the percentage because it probably will be a very big one, as the military now has much more power and influence in senior Communist Party circles.
And Gordon, to what extent do you believe that the stated numbers will be but a fraction of what is actually being invested by the Chinese government in their military programs? That's historically been the case, but is there a greater degree of transparency these days, or is it sort of business as usual in that regard?
It's certainly business as usual. The Chinese stated budget, which was $130 billion last year, was probably $70 to $80 billion short of the real figure at a minimum, because China does not disclose research and development and procurement. And there are other factors that I think are not put into the Chinese budget. So clearly, we're not getting the full picture. We do look at the percentage increase, though, because there is some indication about the direction. And that, of course, is important as well. Last year, the increase in the Chinese military budget, as publicized, was 12.2%. That was well in excess of the growth of the economy and shows, as I mentioned, the influence of China's flag officers. This year, we're all going to be watching that percentage increase, because despite the real problems in China's economy, I think we're going to see a very big announced increase in the budget.
When we do, we will be turning to you, Gordon, to help us make sense of it for sure. Finally, let me just ask you very quickly about the latest developments in the Alibaba saga. There is a lot of controversy about this conglomerate, as we've discussed from time to time with you, Gordon. But what is the latest state of play with respect to Chinese investigations of this firm and its value to those who bought large pieces of it in a recent IPO?
There are two major investigations that are ongoing, and now there are shareholder suits against Alibaba in the United States. There's, I think, been an additional one in the last 2 weeks. This is going to be important because Alibaba is now going to have to manage in a difficult period, not one where it is propelled by all trends. I think we're going to see its share value erode, largely because of all these trends are now mostly negative, not positive, as they were in the past.
We'll be, again, tracking that one closely with you, Gordon. Thank you very much, as always, for your insights into what is going on in sometimes inscrutable places, as well as connecting dots for us where we find developments that really have tremendous strategic implications for us, even if they're not entirely clear their meaning at the moment. We'll keep up the good work, I hope, and join us again next week. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.